dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. In the course of 2020, we have been privileged to speak to lots of people, but few have contributed more, I believe, to the quality of our program and its content than our guest for this full hour of sort of stock-taking on 2020 and a look forward to 2021. Our guest is Gordon Chang. He is an author, an essayist, a frequent pundit on various television and radio programs, including, of course, this one each week. The High Point, I think of it as our week. Gordon is, among other things, the author of The Coming Collapse of China, and most recently, The Great U.S.-China Tech War. He is also a man to be followed at Twitter on his handle, Gordon G. Chang, as do I. I encourage you all to do the same. Gordon, it's great to have you back, and thank you for giving us a full hour of your time. I know how precious it is, and it is so appreciated to be able to talk with you at some length.
Well, Frank, thank you for giving us an hour of your time, so thank you.
Hopefully going to be mutually beneficial and to the great benefit of our audience. Let me ask you, Gordon, first of all, to just maybe level set on where we are with respect to the Chinese Communist Party. I'm mindful of the China dream, as its dictator Xi Jinping has described it, as kind of a rubric within which to look at the various aspects of its behavior in 2020 and what we might expect in 2021. Give us just a quick course on what are Xi's ambitions as expressed in that so-called dream.
Well, Xi Jinping believes that China is the world's only sovereign state. He's been recycling language from the two millennia of emperors, where they believe that China had the mandate of heaven over Tianxia, or all under heaven. And Xi Jinping has been using this imagery for more than a decade, but recently, in the last 3 years, his references have become unmistakable. Chinese officials have talked about this in ways that that we can't avoid. And also, Xi Jinping has been acting like a Tianxia emperor, that only he has the right to do whatever he wants, and that others clearly have no right, including the United States. So this is a really dangerous time, especially because of the coronavirus and everything else. But this is a time where Xi Jinping believes that he can actually make great advances in getting the world to accept this notion of Chinese dominance.
And you mentioned the COVID crisis. The CCP virus is the way I think of it, the Chinese Communist Party virus, unleashed on the rest of the world by Xi, if not deliberately as a form of attack, certainly seized upon by him and the Chinese Communist Party once it was let loose from China, clearly deliberately. Talk a little bit about the virus, Gordon. You've described this as an attack on the entire world, which I think is right, but what do we now know about what the Chinese Communist Party did, perhaps late in 2019, and certainly what it did in the course of 2020?
Well, we know that Xi Jinping took steps that inevitably led to the spread of this disease, and we can be sure he knew what he was doing. So this was an attack on the world, Frank. We don't know the origin of the coronavirus, whether it's naturally occurring or whether it was cooked up in a lab, specifically the Wuhan Institute of Virology. But we do know what happened afterwards. And there are principally two things. There are others, but principally two things. First of all, China announced that this disease was contagious human to human on January 20, but doctors in Wuhan knew this no later than the second week of December, so Beijing knew about it then. And there are some indications, especially the Harvard Medical School study, which would lead us to believe that they knew about this in August. But at least there were 5 weeks when China knew that this was human to human transmissible. But during that time, Xi Jinping did something which is inexplicable if one believes that China is acting in good faith. And that is, China propagated the narrative that this was not readily transmissible from one person to the next. So they lied about contagiousness. At the same time, Xi Jinping pressured countries to accept arrivals from China. At the same time that he was locking down Wuhan, the epicenter, and other locations in China. So he thought that these measures would be effective, which means that by forcing countries to accept passengers from China, that he knew that he was spreading the disease to the rest of the world. So this is an indication, and I think unmistakable one, that this was a spread of the disease which was malicious. So they didn't just let this disease escape from China. They took active steps to make sure that it would happen. This was an attack on the rest of the world, and the world has yet to hold China accountable for this.
Gordon, this is a stunning indictment, and I believe absolutely correct. One other piece of it, of course, and there are many dimensions to this attack, but the enabling of it that was done by the World Health Organization under clearly the domination of China is another important insight into both what the Chinese have been up to in international organizations and their determination to use them as instruments for their control of the planet. Talk a little bit about that, if you would, as well.
Yeah, the WHO was complicit in this, and we know this from a number of different instances. First of all, China was able to spread its disinformation about contagiousness through the WHO, and there's that infamous January 14th tweet from the Director General of the WHO, Dr. Tedros. The WHO supported China's efforts to keep travel going through those critical weeks. So WHO issued statements, for instance, urging countries not to impose travel restrictions and quarantines on arrivals from China. WHO did a number of other things. So, for instance, it delayed a declaration of an international health emergency. And second of all, it delayed the declaration of a pandemic. Now, another thing that China did, which basically showed that it was deliberately spreading the disease, is that after January 20, when it announced human-to-human transmissibility, Beijing then tried to tell the world that the coronavirus was no more contagious or no more deadly than SARS, the 2002-2003 epidemic that infected about 8,400 people worldwide, killed 810, according to official sources. WHO helped China propagate that narrative as well, Frank. So we can see that both Beijing and the World Health Organization were working hand in hand.
There are so many other aspects to this, Gordon, and I want to move on, but just to sort of tie this off, the oppression of those in China who were warning about the virus, the purchase worldwide of available personal protective equipment and other instruments to counter the disease for the use of the Chinese, and the sale of defective equipment by the Chinese all add real insult to the injury of this horrific attack, which has now killed millions, I believe, around the world. Gordon Cheng is our guest. We're going to speak more with him about other aspects of what we've learned about the Chinese Communist Party and its agenda in 2020 right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom. With Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Our guest for this full hour, I'm thrilled to say, is Gordon Cheng. You can follow him at Gordon G. Cheng on Twitter, and also, of course, on this program, Fox News, The National Interest, and so many other outlets, Gatestone Institute, not least, where he makes a magnificent contribution to the public policy debate about an area in which he is one of the country's preeminent experts, Communist China. what it is up to and what it means for us. Gordon, we talked a bit about the coronavirus as one of the very prominent features of China's unrestricted warfare against the United States of 2020. I'd like to talk about another piece that I got into a little bit yesterday in a fascinating conversation with Professor Michael Rechtenwald, formerly of the New York University, and an author on basically the woke culture and what is happening to transform some of these Marxist ideas into a very dangerous form of totalitarianism. He mentioned, among other aspects of this, something that I know you're very familiar with and I believe very concerned about, as am I, namely the so-called social credit system that China has been putting into place. Talk a little bit about what we've learned about that operation in the course of 2020, especially the use that's being made of it to try to exploit the coronavirus even further by gaining data and using it to control populations.
The social credit system is a supposed to be a nationwide system, supposed to be at the end of this year, but they don't, probably not going to make that deadline. And every resident is given a social credit score, which is constantly updated and adjusted based upon observable behaviors. So, for instance, if you don't return a library book in time, your social credit score will go down. If you say something nice about Xi Jinping, the ruler of the country, your score will go up. Now, this is in experiments in various localities around China, and they're in the process of knitting them together into one unified system, which is obviously a gargantuan task. In this, they're aided by what is in place already, 626 million surveillance cameras, and that number increases substantially every year. You know, people talk about China as being authoritarian. Well, at one time it was, but it's heading back to totalitarianism, and the social credit system is one evidence of that, because obviously when all behaviors are observed, we're talking about a total surveillance society. So this, in addition with other things, shows that China's going back to something that resembles the 1950s. China's not there yet, but I don't think we can call it authoritarian anymore.
And I think it's fair to say what they are perfecting at home, they intend to export as well. And we'll talk about that in several other aspects of their global imperialist program in a moment. But just staying with Professor Rechtenwald, one of the other things that he discussed with me, Gordon, was this project called the Great Reset, which seems to have been bringing together under World Economic Forum and other auspices global capitalists in concert with the Chinese communists, unlikely as that may seem, to refashion the world's economy, yes, but its sort of political character as well, notably the sovereignty of individual nation states. And one of the things that I was struck by was something he described as capitalism with Chinese characteristics as a kind of basis upon which this, unlikely marriage of convenience might be fashioned. Do you have thoughts on how the Chinese are using capitalists in this country and elsewhere, Davos among them, to advance their ambitions internationally?
Well, the Communist Party uses every point of contact with the society to further its agenda, which in our case is the overthrow of the U.S. government. And so it has worked very hard with the business community, and especially Wall Street, to pursue its agenda. This became very clear with those comments from Professor Di Dongsheng of Renmin University in Beijing. They were made November 28th and publicized across China. And indeed, we've seen them now on YouTube, where Professor Di talks about how China was looking forward to the return of its friends to power in the United States, obviously referring to the election of Joe Biden as president. He was actually chortling because he was saying that in prior administrations prior to Trump, China could determine outcomes at the highest levels of the American political system, that system was broken, or China's connection was broken during the Trump administration when the president was not listening to Wall Street, and they then think that it will now return with Biden. So with the business community and not only Wall Street, China does its very best. And we can see this in one particular example that people have been talking about recently, and that is the Republican governor of Georgia, Brian Kemp, who has been touting his state's business relationship with China. So it's not just the business community, it's everybody that does business, including the American political class.
Several points on that it's worth just noting. A very significant effort was made just in the past couple of weeks by President Trump and his team to intensify the pressure on Wall Street to stop underwriting the Chinese Communist Party, specifically its People's Liberation Army-tied companies. And I want to salute the president and his folks, particularly Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and his team, for holding the line on efforts by the Treasury Department to, let Wall Street do that kind of running dog thing for the Chinese Communist Party. Gordon, speaking of Mike Pompeo, of course, back in February, he warned the governor, including Brian Kemp, I believe, that China was working to co-opt or otherwise take advantage of them. Subsequent warnings have been issued by, among others, the Director of National Intelligence about China trying to blackmail members of Congress. So you're absolutely right. The focus on the political class of this country is intense. But it's just one sort of facet of what China is trying to do to bend us to their will. And this brings me to this larger question of their interference in our election campaign this time around to defeat Donald Trump. What do we know, to your way of thinking, about the degree and the impact of China's interference in our 2020 presidential election?
There are two main initiatives that China had. One of them was malicious disinformation campaigns, and those were conducted this year mainly by two entities, the Foreign Ministry, which is China's central government, and the Global Times, which is a Communist Party tabloid, not official, but often implementing official policies. So, for instance, there was something about the coronavirus, a disinformation campaign which was intended, I think, to make life difficult for the President of the United States. And also there was one on the George Floyd protests and several others. The second major initiative were their troll and bot farm operations. This was below the surface. This is what the Russians have done in the past. The Chinese, though, ramped it up. And we see this with operations such as Spamouflage Dragon, which relentlessly attacked President Trump through YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter. We know that China's operations were massive. The social media platforms were constantly taking down fake Chinese accounts. Twitter in June took down 174,000 fake Chinese accounts. So you can see the scale of this dwarfed anything that Russia was doing. Also, China, I think, was instigating violence on American streets. Radio Free Asia reports that an intelligence unit of the People's Liberation Army actually based themselves in the Houston consulate, which has now been closed. But they based themselves there, and they, using big data and artificial intelligence, identified Americans likely to participate in Antifa and Black Lives Matter protests, and then through TikTok sent those Americans videos on how to riot. That is an act of war, Frank. Also, there are unconfirmed reports, but many of them that need to be investigated, about how Chinese protesters, including those in Washington, D.C., were people speaking Mandarin, obviously acting in coordination with other Chinese protesters, and actually some of them were overheard saying things that suggested that they were put on the streets by the Chinese central government. As I mentioned, those reports are unconfirmed, but they do match reports of Chinese protesters in Los Angeles and other Southern California locations. So this was a direct involvement in violent protests in the United States, and this goes well beyond subversion.
Yes, it does. And Gordon, just a couple of other things to add to that list. The United Front Work Department of the Chinese Communist Party seems to have been directly involved with not only the Chinese Progressive Association, but Black Lives Matter, the organization, and Antifa. So it's part of, as you say, a larger and quite comprehensive effort to subvert us, but beyond that, to bring us down. There's also been reporting by our friend Trevor Loudon about Chinese involvement with groups like Seed the Vote, engaged in registration drives to try to turn out people to vote the way they'd like, and actual involvement perhaps in some of these election systems themselves, that is to say, voting machines and tabulation and so on. That's an unfolding story, but I think what you take away from all of this in 2020 is the Chinese were determined to defeat Donald Trump and have gone to great lengths to try to accomplish that. Gordon, when we come back, I want to talk a bit more about some of the other aspects of the Chinese threat as it has been metastasizing both elsewhere around the world and here. And we'll be right back with Gordon Chang for that purpose momentarily.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are visiting for this full hour with one of our country's leading authorities on the Chinese Communist Party and what its designs are on our country and the world and what we best be doing about it. We're going to turn to that topic in a moment. But before we do, I want to continue with Gordon Chang's visit about what we've learned about the Chinese Communist Party and its ambitions and its capabilities to achieve them in the course of this momentous year, 2020. Gordon, I wanted to talk with you a bit about how China's conduct, both towards its own people and those it has enslaved or is in the process of enslaving, speaks volumes about the nature of the party, as well as its, as I say, its ambitions. Let's talk a little bit about what happened in Hong Kong. In part, I think it's fair to say, made greatly easier for them to accomplish as a result of the coronavirus and the suppression of the demonstrations that had taken place in Hong Kong.
This year, the most important event was the passage of the National Security Law by the National People's Congress in Beijing, bypassing Hong Kong's Legislative Council. This was draconian, as people say correctly, that this was the end of law in Hong Kong. And what Beijing has been doing for this half year has been trying to suppress all expressions of dissent. In the last 6 months, it looks like it's been successful, but people in Hong Kong are still expressing dissent in various ways, and the courts are actually handing Beijing some defeats. But clearly, we're seeing leading democracy figures being put behind bars, including Jimmy Lai, the publisher of Apple Daily, the main pro-democracy newspaper. This is an insurgency, Frank, which means it can melt away, but insurgencies always come back, and I think we're going to see that Beijing has not actually won this conflict.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, my friend, especially as it looks as though they have in mind doing similar repressive things to the people of Taiwan. Gordon, I noted the other day with growing concern that on top of all of the things that the Chinese Communist Party has been doing to pressure Taiwan, to intimidate it, to threaten it, and in some cases to seemingly test its ability to invade it. There was the announcement of the completion of a new high-speed rail line to move personnel and, well, as they put it, to facilitate trans-strait traffic, which it seems to be particularly ominous against that backdrop. What's the latest situation as you see it vis-a-vis Taiwan?
Taiwan is becoming more and more anti-China, if you can use that term. People in Taiwan want, of course, good relations with Beijing, but they don't. But they say that they are Taiwanese. Beijing, of course, says that Taiwan is its 34th province. And what we have seen, especially as Beijing has pressed Hong Kong, that people in Taiwan are less and less inclined to give Beijing a break. So Taiwan has moved very clearly this year toward the United States, toward Japan and India. And indeed, other countries in the region are building links with Taiwan. So Taiwan has been a particular failure for Xi Jinping this year.
I hope that it will remain thus. It does seem as though he's increasingly emboldened in terms of the threats to Taiwan. And should there be a Biden presidency, I fear that that would be something that may yet be acted upon. Gordon, sticking with what the Chinese are doing to people they consider their own, talk a little bit about the oppression of what I think of as captive nations in China, the Uyghurs of East Turkestan, the Tibetans, and Southern Mongolians specifically.
Well, this year it's become clear that China is engaging not just in oppression, but in crimes against humanity. There's been the detention of at least 1 million, perhaps as many as 3 million Uyghurs and Kazakhs and others in what China calls Xinjiang, its northwest, what the local inhabitants call East Turkestan. But there's also been acts of genocide. There's been institutionalization of rape. Also, these mass slave labor programs. The most recent to get caught appears to be Apple, which has the glass for its computers made with forced Uyghur and Kazakh labor. And there's also, in all probability, forced organ harvesting. We know that Uyghurs and Kazakhs not only are being disappeared, but are being killed. These are the worst crimes against humanity that we have seen since the Second World War. And matter of fact, what China's doing right now is worse than what the Third Reich did prior to the mass exterminations, which began in 1941. This is just horrific. It's unspeakable.
It is, indeed. It seems as though it is in prospect for others around the globe as well, states that are not yet fully enslaved by the Chinese Communist Party, but that are targeted by it through something that Xi Jinping calls his Belt and Road Initiative. I know you feel as though it may be coming a cropper, which would be a very good thing, but talk a little bit about what Xi's purpose is trying to essentially bring countries from Asia to Europe to Latin America under Beijing's sway.
Well, the Belt and Road Initiative is a plan to build infrastructure around the world so that everything is tied to China. And this was announced in 2013. Originally, it was just to connect China to Europe, but now it's to connect China with the entire world. So, for instance, there's a Polar Silk Road, which is a part of this, a Latin America Belt and Road, a Caribbean Belt and Road, and all the rest of it. Now, significantly, they added the Digital Silk Road, which is an attempt to tie all communications to China. The original Belt and Road program is not working out as China wanted to. It seems that many of these projects are running out of money, and Beijing is being debt-trapped as it's trying to debt-trap others. But the Digital Silk Road is actually succeeding with Huawei Technologies, the world's number one manufacturer of telecom networking gear, as well as the world's biggest maker of smartphones. So this is a grand plan, and this is something that the United States needs to do more to oppose. We're making some headway, especially with the clean initiative of the State Department, but nonetheless, this is a real struggle, and in many respects, we're not succeeding. One thing about this, even though the Belt and Road big plan doesn't seem to be working, it does seem to be creating opportunities for China to build naval bases. One of them is within 90 miles of Palm Beach, Florida. That's a $3 billion container port project in Freeport in the Bahamas, completely unjustified from an economic point of view. But I think we could see very well the Chinese Navy based basically 90 miles from Palm Beach in the not-too-distant future as that project fails. Economic.
Because that's how this works, of course, Gordon, as you know. You see these facilities being constructed, perhaps for one purpose, whether it's seaports or railway networks, road networks, airports. But when the Chinese expropriate them, when the debt trap initiatives succeed, wind up being able to essentially expropriate them and use them for whatever purpose they wish. You know, Gordon, there's a point that I've just learned recently from a colleague in Nigeria that the Belt and Road Initiative agreement with Nigeria says in the fine print, mind you, and in Mandarin only, that should Nigeria fail to make its payments on the various infrastructure improvements that the Chinese are making under the Belt and Road Initiative there, Nigeria will surrender its sovereignty, not just the assets themselves. This is presumably something that they're building into a lot of these deals, but even if it's just naval facilities or other power projection assets, it's very worrying, which brings us to the next point, Gordon. Talk a bit about what we have seen around the world in 2020, both in the Pacific, of course, but more broadly as well, in terms of both the build-out and the deployment of Chinese military power.
We've seen, just taking Belt and Road, for instance, China's only offshore military base is in Djibouti in the Horn of Africa. Djibouti, prior to the opening of that base, was heavily indebted to China because of a number of loans taken out for infrastructure projects. So this is a real example of what you just talked about, of China turning debt trap diplomacy into military bases. And we have seen, for instance, Chinese military assets pulling into container ports, specifically the Colombo container port in Sri Lanka, where you had a nuclear attack submarine and its tender visit twice in 2014. China took over the Hambantota port in Sri Lanka as well. And that is a real indication that China would like to use this debt trap diplomacy. Fortunately for us, China has overextended itself. This is Paul Kennedy's imperial overstretch at work. And we can actually try to do a lot to make sure that China doesn't get its money back and therefore cripple its Belt and Road. But in the meantime, Frank, this is actually very worrying, as you point out.
Yeah, and it's one of the reasons why our Committee on the Present Danger China, Gordon, has been emphasizing both the insights and hard experiences of enslaved peoples within China itself as a means of trying to impress upon the people of the Belt and Road targeted nations what's in store for them. And the hope is that we will see, just as you say, growing resistance to both the Chinese neo-imperial or colonial ambitions, as well as what they intend to do that would be harmful to us in building on those assets and the resources that they're obtaining and the like, to the great detriment of our security as well as that of others around the world, including, of course, the nations most immediately involved. This brings us to what we're going to do about all of this, which will be the topic of our fourth and final installment of this very special end-of-year conversation with the great Gordon Chang, which we will turn to right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Gordon Chang is in the house virtually for this fourth and final installment of our special end-of-year conversation with one of the great minds, the great freedom fighters, really, on China in America today. Gordon, the question now occurs, what do we do about China? We are certainly at a pivotal moment. If they have their way, they will have elected a new administration that is, well, to say aligned with it, I think understates the point. We have, as far as I'm concerned, still the possibility that we'll have four more years of a Trump administration, which is clearly much more attuned to the sorts of concerns you've expressed. But under either commander-in-chief, Gordon, what should America's policy be towards China in light of the very serious threats we've seen emerge or be reinforced in 2020?
I believe we must cut all contact with the Chinese regime. And that means no trade, no investment, no technology sharing agreements. We close all their consulates. We cut back the embassy staff to just the ambassador. And by the way, as a side note, we should be expelling the current ambassador because he, along with someone from the New York consulate, tried to recruit a scientist in Connecticut as a spy for China. That is obviously activity which is inconsistent with Ambassador Choi Tenkai's status in the United States. We should remove him. We should tell Beijing, yeah, you can send another ambassador, but we'll remove that ambassador as well if they engage in unacceptable conduct. I know this sounds extreme, but the point is, as we mentioned earlier, China uses every point of contact to overthrow the U.S. government, and we have obviously been unsuccessful in what we've been doing up to now in terms of trying to protect ourselves from the Communist Party. So I believe that if we want to retain our sovereignty and our freedoms and our way of life, the only way we can do this in the short term is to cut virtually all contact.
You know, it does sound extreme, I'm sure, to many people's ears, Gordon, but what occurs to me is that's not unlike what one does when you are at war with an adversary. And as we've talked about in the course of 2020, oftentimes in the years before, you have been very clear-eyed about the fact that we are at war with China, the people's war, they call it, the unrestricted warfare that they've been pursuing against us. And so we have a great many people in this country who have either failed to understand that reality or are willfully blind to it, notably in Wall Street and some other quarters where there's money to be made doing business with China. But it does seem to me that this is a moment for a serious debate about that sort of approach, because, as you say, otherwise we really do risk losing our country entirely. Let me ask you, just to drill down on something we touched on earlier, Gordon, how important is it in particular that we end the practice, by Wall Street notably, of underwriting and thereby enabling not just these Chinese People's Liberation Army companies, which is obviously unacceptable, but other companies that are subject to the National Intelligence Law, Article 7 of China? Talk a little bit about that and how broadly that applies.
China's National Intelligence Law of 2017 in Articles 7 and 14 require every Chinese national and every Chinese company to spy if demanded, which means that all of these companies, whether they're state-owned or whether they're private, are under a compulsion to spy. And we know, for instance, that TikTok, which is owned by ByteDance, which is a private Chinese company, has been doing the bidding of the Communist Party. As we talked about in connection with the Houston consulate, as we talked about in an earlier segment today. So this is unfortunate in a sense, but we've got to remember that India banned TikTok and banned hundreds of other Chinese apps. And so the question is, why can't we do this? And it's not just a question of bad conduct or potentially bad conduct. China doesn't allow American apps in China. So why are we allowing Chinese apps in our country? This is just a question of basic reciprocity, which is separate and apart from the bad conduct, which we can prove. But it shows that fundamentally, we Americans have got this relationship with China 100% wrong.
Reciprocity is such a key point, and I think most Americans would immediately appreciate it's the only appropriate basis for dealing, particularly with a hostile power like China. And yet it is mostly honored in the breach, is it not? What should we be doing with notably the Quad, but more generally the Asia-Pacific nations that are also worried about China most especially?
Well, the Quad is a loose grouping of the United States, Japan, Australia, and India. And this is an idea which has been floating around for quite some time. But in the last two or three years, the four countries have been operationalizing their relationship. And this is becoming an effective grouping. We need to do this more than we've done in the past. But also, you know, the Middle East is technically part of Asia. And President Trump has done something very similar with the Abraham Accords, where you see Israel and Sunni Arab states are working together. And to great credit of the Trump administration, Morocco has also signed a deal and now recognizing Israel. So this whole idea of building partnerships with like-minded countries, you know, there's a sense that we should be doing this in Europe. This is going to be more difficult because Europe is going its own way and China has been successful in peeling it off. But this is the general approach that the United States needs to adopt, which is working more closely with its allies, friends, and partners. And there's been, as I mentioned, great progress on both ends of Asia during the Trump years.
But this brings, again, to mind the grave concern about this so-called digital Silk Road, because to the extent that countries do succumb to the temptation to use Chinese 5G and other telecom technologies, there will be, I'm afraid, an infrastructure that undermines our alliance relationships. We've already warned that, you know, you use Huawei, you can't have access to our intelligence because it would be compromised. So, again, this requires a redoubled effort on all of these scores. Let me ask you about one other initiative we've touched on from time to time, Gordon, and you made the point yourself a moment ago, which I think speaks to it, and the need to have this as one of the elements of our kit in contending with the Chinese Communist Party threat, and that is to have it designated as what it is, namely a transnational criminal organization. You spoke of the crimes against humanity, which are evident in China, but there are also innumerable others that have been waged, including against our country and our people, starting where we did at the beginning, with some 330,000 of us being murdered by the Chinese Communist Party virus. And then there's the fentanyl, and then there's the economic hollowing out of our industrial base and technology theft and so much more. All of which has, by the way, been amply documented by the U.S. government, particularly during the Trump years. Gordon, should we be so designating the Chinese Communist Party as a means of trying to delegitimate it, as Ronald Reagan did the Soviet Union with his evil empire strategy, as well as making it more difficult for those in our own country, as well as elsewhere, to continue to try to help enable and underwrite and empower the Chinese Communist Party, because they would be perhaps accomplices to criminal activity?
We should designate the Communist Party as a transnational criminal organization, and we should be bringing a RICO case, racketeer-influenced corrupt organization case, against the Communist Party, because the designation really is just a way station to a RICO case. You know, we have seen China engage in ordinary criminal activity. Put apart, for instance, crimes against humanity, put apart the coronavirus. We have seen China with these fentanyl gangs, which cannot operate without the tolerance of the Communist Party, bring fentanyl and its compounds into the U.S. There was the case of China counterfeiting currency. This is from January of this year, where you have China counterfeiting 900,000 $1 bills, which is a big story in itself, which you can't counterfeit U.S. currency in China without the Communist Party knowing about it. You've talked about the bringing in of automatic weapons parts, which I think were firing pins. They were seized in Kentucky and I believe in May. But there are so many of these seizures of contraband, and these gangs could not operate without the Communist Party knowing about it. So we should be holding the Communist Party responsible criminally for these acts. You put them all together, you've got a great RICO case. It needs to be brought by the administration, and if not by this one, then by the Biden team.
Well, a great program of action for 2021. Gordon, we look forward to talking with you often in its course. Thank you for all that you've done to contribute to our program this year and much more broadly to the security of the United States. God bless you, my friend. Come back to us soon. Hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.